This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from its slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Or should I say, Happy Halloween. We are still about a week or so away from the Halloween holiday, or Day of the Dead, as some proclaim it and celebrate. But I thought it would be kind of interesting to do something that has to do with science and the science of magic. And when I was in Phoenix a few years ago at the IBM International Convention, I ran across a flyer that was being handed out by Dr. Anthony Barnhart. And he was running a scientific study at a local university and was encouraging people to come down to the university to be studied, to undergo this little project that he had. Well, I never got a chance actually to sit down and talk with him, nor to actually go to the university to be involved with this study. And I regret on both counts that I didn't get a chat with him nor to be involved with that study. But I did keep the brochure and had followed up on it some years later, and I just, it's kind of like most of us, I guess, we just kind of, most magicians are not accumulators. I think we're, some people might call us hoarders. Okay, I'm a collector. I like that better than a hoarder. And I was going across just some stuff and cleaning out my desk, and as I did, I came across this pamphlet, this flyer, and I thought, well, I wonder if he's still around. So I sent an email, and since that time, he had moved from Arizona, and I was able to track him down in Kenosha. As a result, we were able to actually talk with each other via Skype, and I got an update on how the project went while he was in Arizona, and apparently it's an ongoing project, and he is still looking for subjects. And now he lives closer to Chicago, and he has access to a lot more magicians, I guess, in and around that area. And encouraging people to come and help him with completing this study. It sounds very fascinating and very interesting, and I think as you get into this, you'll find that it has some applications that will, I believe, ultimately help us all as performers. So, I'm not going to say much more and just kind of let Tony talk about what his project is and how you can be involved with this study then, too. So, please welcome Tony Barnhart, Ph.D., here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I have with me is my guest today, Mr. Tony Barnhart, who is a professor at in the Department of Psychological Science in Carthage College, which is in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Have I got that right?
That's correct.
Ah, good. And before this, you were in Arizona at ASU, is that right?
So I did all my graduate work at Arizona State University. That's where I got started doing what I'm doing. But I've been at Northern Arizona University in beautiful Flagstaff for the last couple years before I moved back to the Midwest.
Well, that's nice and cool up there as opposed to being warmer down in Phoenix or even in Tucson.
Yeah, it was great in Flagstaff, and Phoenix is not meant to be inhabited by humans.
Yeah, that's about as close to the sun as you could be there.
That's right.
Well, how long were you actually in Arizona then?
Almost a decade.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep, about 5 years longer than I'd hoped to be.
So you're not from Arizona, obviously, originally.
No, grew up in Illinois. Did all my early magic training in Illinois, and then moved out to Arizona for graduate school.
Well, now that's kind of cool. Whereabouts in Illinois?
So I grew up in rural Illinois, middle of nowhere, but near-ish to Rockford, Illinois, where there was a great magic shop called Magic Manor, run by a guy named Rich Goff. Mm-hmm. From whom I did much of my early learning. Took a lot of classes from him along the way.
When you said rural Illinois, I thought you can't be too much further away from where I was brought up. I'm from Salem, Illinois, which is in southern Illinois.
Yeah.
Like in the middle.
I was almost in Iowa. I was northwest corner.
Yeah, so that was pretty rural. So that was a farming community up in your area too, I assume.
That's right. Cornfields on two sides of my home.
Did you go to school? Did you get your undergraduate degree then in Illinois?
So I did my undergraduate work at a little place called Augustana College, right on the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And that's where I first got interested in the interface of psychology and magic. I had great professors there who encouraged me to give a few early talks box on how magicians exploit psychology, and that's really kind of what pushed me in the direction that I've gone. And I ended up going to graduate school for cognitive psychology, and cognitive psychologists are experimental psychologists who study the building blocks of thought, things like memory and perception and attention and language and all the things that magicians exploit really well.
Well, most do, and some don't even know they are doing it. I think they're doing it just because they learned some magic, and that's because the misdirection is something that's going to be something that they should study more of that side of it. You know, I guess, again, that by way of introduction of why we wanted to get together to talk was about your study on the science of magic and what all that you have been doing and working on that. There was something that I had read just recently that had to do with comedy, and that is laughter and why that people laugh at magic. And because sometimes it's in spite of yourself, and there are certain overlaps as to, and not necessarily as it relates to magic, but as it relates just to why things are funny, and when sometimes you are surprised by something, why that you would laugh. Now, is that part of your study then too?
That's tangentially related to what I do. One of the questions that I'm trying to answer is, how do offbeats work?
Sure.
Magicians talk about offbeats a lot, and this is an area of study that I think is actually important to psychology. Lots of psychologists study how attention operates in space, so like this, using the spotlight analogy that magicians also use. But not a lot of psychologists consider how attention operates in time. And so this is a place where magicians can actually provide a lot of information for psychologists, because magicians have these deep intuitions about how attention can be momentarily suppressed in what they call an offbeat. Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of magic theorists that write with the specificity that science requires to test these things. So a lot of the work that I've been doing is trying to figure out how theories from magic can be turned into hypotheses that can be tested in the laboratory, specifically in the domain of these offbeats. And as you know, humor is one of the ways to create an offbeat.
And an offbeat is that moment then when a person is misdirected. Is that correct?
Yeah, the moment when they can be looking but not seeing.
Okay.
So I often think of offbeats as being independent of sort of spatial misdirection. So we saw, for example, El Goshman did these all the time. Every time that he was sneaking a coin under a salt shaker, he was doing it at a moment of surprise or a moment of revelation, right? Like he would reveal that the coin was under the salt shaker, and he'd use that moment of surprise, that offbeat, to load the next coin under the salt shaker.
Because a person is blinking, and in that moment when they're blinking or throwing their head back or laughing or turning to look at someone else is perfect.
You know, I don't even think they need to be blinking in that moment or turning their head away.
Okay.
Because what I think is going on, and this is one of the questions I'm trying to get at, is what's happening in that moment is mental time travel, right? When they see that coin under the salt shaker, they're searching their memory to reconstruct how that coin may have gotten there.
And when it went,
searching your memory takes away attentional resources from the world around them, blinding them to large events that could be available to them if they were attending.
Well, that's interesting, because sometimes things can happen, obviously, directly under your nose and in front of your eyes that you are plainly seeing, but it's a different a different memory that you have of it. For an example, if someone is involved in a car accident or sees a car accident and they're a witness to that, there's a perfect example, I think, in which you have different people having different stories of having seen the same thing because it happened in a moment. It was a crash. Something happened that, I saw this, even though they could be at the same angle. It's not necessarily, blind men, grabbing a tail or a trunk or whatever and trying to describe what the animal is. They could be standing still in the same corner, but one person says, well, the light was green. The other one said, no, it was red. Or whatever.
Yeah.
So, is that kind of what you're saying? Is that people can see things under their nose, but they're not seeing it?
And I think what you're talking about is also a part of the story. How can magicians use language to change how memories are formed? Right. The problem in your scenario is that after people experienced something, they then conversed about it, and one person's memories changed another person's memories.
And so I think that's one of kind of what mentalists will do, I guess.
Exactly.
In wonder words, like Kent Nepper talks about, and neurolinguistics. Okay.
Yeah, and I think one of the places where maybe the psychology can inform magic is in that very area, because we know that emotions can influence susceptibility to that kind of misinformation. And we're starting to learn more about how certain emotional states can open a person up to illusory memories. So that's perhaps an area where mentalists can glean some information from psychological research as we work through that problem. But I'm really focused on low-level attention. How can magicians influence when you are attending, not necessarily where you're attending? So humor is one of those, because humor seems to operate the same way that Al Goshman's moment of surprise works, right? So when people see that coin under the salt shaker, they begin trying to reconstruct how it got there.
Mm-hmm.
The same happens when you're hearing a joke, right? Jokes have this clear structure. They have a setup. They have a punchline. The setup creates this expectation, and the punchline doesn't match that expectation. So the only way to make sense of the joke is to travel back in time and reinterpret that setup in light of the punchline, this new construct.
And your mind is working in milliseconds in order to try to make those
connecting dots. In order to do that, you have to focus attention inward toward memory, searching memory to figure out what came before and make new sense of it in light of this new constraint, the punchline.
Mm-hmm.
So,
now, do you discern a difference, as Tommy Wonder did, in talking about direction versus misdirection?
So I teach classes on this stuff too. I teach a whole class on the psychology of magic. And one of the themes of the class is how hard it is to come to agreements on what certain terms mean.
Mm-hmm.
And misdirection is one of these terms,
mm-hmm.
where all magicians we have an understanding of what constitutes misdirection, but it's lots of different things,
sure.
right? There's a whole bunch of stuff that falls under that umbrella term of misdirection. And unfortunately, the same thing is true in psychological research with attention. Attention is not just one thing. It's an umbrella term that includes lots of different features. So I try not to enter myself into that debate of whether we should be talking about direction or misdirection, because kind of everybody's right, I think.
Yeah, okay.
The terms have a lot of different meanings, and I think as far as science is concerned, we should just try and break down these terms and assess each of their individual meanings independently. I think, was it Buckley? I think Walter Buckley was one of the guys who started that debate, who said, we need to throw away the term misdirection, that what we're really doing is focusing attention towards certain features at the expense of others. We should use directed attention rather than misdirection. But
really, it's all semantics, I guess, basically.
It's all semantics in the end.
Right. So you're trying to get beyond the semantics, but actually to the root of whatever that it actually is, whether they call direction or misdirection. It's immaterial as to what the bottom line that you're trying to do. Now in Phoenix,
put these in scientific terms that are really easily tested.
Well,
that's a hard problem.
True. In law, every word means something different. Every little nuance, certainly has a completely different meaning. If you say something and you think you're being clear, well, apparently you're not. And so in psychology, as it relates to magic, that's not necessarily the case?
Well, I mean, so when I'm teaching students how to do science writing, it's all about clarity. It's all about using the simplest words you can that communicate most clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And misdirection is just not one of these words. It's not a clear word. It can be interpreted all sorts of different ways. So, yeah, I think we're a little bit different than law in that instance, that we're going for clarity and simplicity in as much of our communication as we can. I don't know.
Well, when we were in Phoenix and we had the IBM convention that was going on there, that is how I first came in contact with you. Whenever that you had this form that was kind of going around and saying, I'm having these tests at the lab, come on down, we'd like to engage you in this, and tell a little bit about what you were doing at that time.
Well, so I can't tell you a lot because it's ongoing.
Okay.
I haven't been as successful as I'd like to be in getting magicians into the laboratory. In a nutshell, I am interested in how training in magic can change the way that you think about the world.
Wow.
The way that you attend to the world, the way that you process information in the world. Are there advantages that are conferred by being trained in deception? And are there places where you're actually harmed, where you are limited in your awareness of the world by virtue of this expertise? And so I have a bunch of different little sub-experiments going on. I've been collecting data here and there for a few years. Just not at the place where I have enough participants that I can make firm conclusions.
Is it just because you can't find enough magicians?
Testing yet. Pardon?
You can't just find enough magicians then to conduct the experiments, or what?
I can't get enough magicians to commit to coming into the laboratory.
Okay, interesting.
I mean, granted, I'm asking quite a bit of magicians. Uh-huh. I think first there's fear. There's fear that they're going to be played for rubes. That's not happening. Mm-hmm. But the complication here is that I have a magical routine that I constructed with Sean Eric, one of my collaborators in the Phoenix area. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a complicated coin routine that I'm asking magicians to try to learn in a short amount of time before coming into the laboratory. I'm not looking for perfection on it, but you know, lots of magicians want to have perfection before they come into the laboratory to perform it. And so I think that's the stumbling block. They think I'm expecting something more than I'm really expecting out of them. But to all the magicians listening, don't be scared. This shouldn't be intimidating. This should really just be fun. I'm interested in probing how the magician's mind operates. And I'm trying to get magicians at all areas of expertise in all different subfields of magic. And it's been a challenge.
I recently had a conversation with Mike Edwards talking about the Alpha Project. Mm-hmm. And he is living in Phoenix.
Yeah.
Of course, he and Steve Shaw or Banachek were the two who were involved with the Alpha Project. And you're, I'm sure, very familiar with all of that. And at the time, one of the things I kind of took away from that conversation was how the scientists had already reached the end of their experiment. In other words, they had a preconceived notion of what they were looking for, and they were trying to find things to support saying, yep, this exists, yep, that works, and yes, and so they kind of let the controls go.
Yeah, yep, and that was a huge problem, and that was the problem that James Randi was trying to publicize.
Expose.
With the entire parapsychology movement.
Right.
It wasn't about learning reality. It was about finding evidence to support the positions that they already held. And that's not how science is meant to operate.
Exactly right. And in that case, I'm assuming, obviously, that you have no preconceived notion. You're just trying to... You don't have an end that you're trying to prove or a point, necessarily, that you're just trying to understand the mind of the...
Yeah, I'm just trying to ascertain what is real.
Right.
That is, how does the mind operate? And how does the mind change when you are adept at deceiving others? Or it may not change at all.
Yeah,
it's hard to say. I'm exploring not only how the mind changes when you are deceiving, but also the process by which you learn to deceive. So that's one of the goals of this little subcomponent I was talking about with the coin trick. What's the process that a magician goes through when learning material that may be a little bit foreign to them?
Mm-hmm.
Can't go into much more detail on that without tipping the actual hypotheses that are being tested. Don't want to bias my participants, but
right.
I think it's the experiments that I'm running with magicians, I think, actually have the power to help magic in the long run, so long as I can get enough participants to make it happen.
Some years ago, I was interviewing for a job in the corporate world, and they had all of their potential interviewees to go through a 1 day of testing with a psychiatrist and, or psychologist, and you had to take written tests, and you would speak to him for a couple of hours, and basically just kind of had to vet you to make sure that you were going to be able to play nice with the rest of the group that you were going to be working with, et cetera, like that. When he found out that I was a magician, that it took him in a completely different off to a tangent. He said, okay, let's kind of set aside what I wanted to ask you about, but he said, I don't get to talk with people who are magicians, and his line of thinking or questioning had to do then more with, why did you get into this? What is it about magic? Is it that you want to fool people, deceive people? Do you want to cheat people? You know, looking at kind of the negative side of this as opposed to saying, you know, entertaining people, or what is it that you want to get out of it, you know? So it was kind of an interesting line of discussion for about a half hour. We kind of took a side path over there.
Sure.
So I can understand, you know, why that a psychologist would certainly want to understand not just why they do things, but not how they do things, but why they're doing things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot to be learned about expertise in all sorts of different disciplines. Much of what we know about the psychology of expertise up to this point is from the study of chess players. Which is sort of strange, but the reason that it's so easy to study expertise in chess players is that you can really easily quantify their expertise, right? Mm-hmm. They have national ranking systems that allow you to put a number on expertise, and that's one of the problems that I've been trying to address in studying magic, is how do I actually quantify expertise? And I've come to no answers on that. It probably can't be done in magic because there's so many different ways you could have expertise in magic, right? Like having expertise in kids' magic is kind of a different beast than having expertise in mental magic. And the subdisciplines don't necessarily get along real well in the training areas that lead to good performance. So that's been one of the challenges I've been trying to get past, or actually, as it's turned out, ignore completely.
Yeah, the only scientific experiment thing I know about was from so many years ago, specifically relating to magicians, was, is the hand quicker than the eye? That was a phrase, and it was at Jastrow, I believe, had done some studies on this in the 20s or something. And I don't know much of anything that's been done since. Of course, he proved that it wasn't, but... anyhow, so do you feel like you're breaking new ground? Is this something that hasn't been tested before?
Yeah, I mean, magic is becoming a hot topic
television.
In psychological science again. In psychological research, magic is becoming a hot topic. In the last 10 or 15 years, it's become hot, and it hadn't been hot up until a century ago when Joseph Jastrow was doing his work. And I don't know how this is a bit of a tangent, but it's a great story. In the last decade of the 1800s, there was this widespread, kind of out of nowhere, interest in studying how magicians deceive from a psychological perspective. And some of the biggest names in psychology wrote papers on this topic, like Alfred Binet of intelligence testing fame, Joseph Jastrow, there were a number of other folks. And the reason that this came about is because of the spiritualist movement. In the 1800s, spiritualism was catching on like nobody's business in the United States. And the Fox sisters were traveling all over doing their seances and things like this. And the
Davenport brothers.
Yeah. And the Society for Psychical Research was founded to try to get at what psychics were all about, whether there were other planes that they could be gathering information from, and whether they could commune with the dead and things like this. Mm-hmm. And some of the early supporters of that group were people like Joseph Jastrow and William James, maybe a name you know from psychology. But they quickly realized that the people who had joined this group had alternative motivations. Just like the parapsychologists in the 1970s, these scientists were interested in proving that you can commune with the spirits, not in ascertaining what was real. and they weren't doing good research, and they weren't asking the right questions. And so this group of psychologists said, we're getting nowhere with this. Perhaps the best way forward is to explore how magicians operate. Psychics aren't likely to tell us that they're being deceptive, but magicians are going to be honest in that right. they are deceiving the senses.
Right.
So a lot of these psychologists turned their focus to magic to try to see what we can learn about the fallibility of memory and perception based on the techniques of magicians. And all these papers came out, and Joseph Jastrow explored expertise with Harry Keller and Alexander Herman in the laboratory. And then, for people who know sort of the history of psychology, the behaviorist revolution happened, which said we can't think about the mind anymore. We can only look at behaviors, inputs, and outputs. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of squelched the scientific study of magic altogether until the last 20 years or so, when this has been back on the table. And we have a few folks to thank, a fellow over in the UK named Gustav Kuhn. In the mid to late 90s, started publishing work using magic in the laboratory to study attention and perception. And then the people that inspired me to go down this track, Steve Macnick and Susanna Martinez-Conde, who were at Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, mm-hmm. just down the road from where I did my graduate work, who wrote the book Sleights of Mind back in 2010, I guess. I ended up being one of their consultants for the book. I was their magic teacher for about a year and constructed an act for them to audition for the Magic Castle. And so the interest that that book garnered pushed me in the direction of making this a big part of my research output. Because mm-hmm. I went to grad school to be a language researcher.
Well, are they continuing with their studies?
Pardon?
Are they continuing with that study since publishing that book in 2010?
They are. So that book was really more about theory than about research in a lot of ways. It was about ideas that magicians had generated and how did these jive with what we know about neuroscience, because okay. there hadn't been a whole lot of research at that time. Mm-hmm. But now they are moving into doing, you know, formal laboratory research on some of these topics. And they've published quite a bit of stuff on the topic. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself when I was seeing these papers come out, I'm a moron if I don't exploit the training that I have in magic and the years that I've sure. devoted to stuff in the laboratory. I mean, I think there's a lot that can be learned from magicians, and I have unique training that could help us learn quickly, I hope.
Yeah. One of the things also, I was thinking back about the conversation with Mike Edwards and James Randi again, that they had the scientists having those expectations. But one of the things was the reason that they had the grant to begin with at Washington University was because of the McDonnell Douglas, mm-hmm. who had paid the $500,000 to the Mac Lab, was basically because he was thinking of this for commercial success, specifically that he had some of his test pilots who had been killed or died, you know, test piloting some of the planes that they had built, and he wanted to find out if he could actually speak to the dead, and they could say, oh, this is what went wrong with this particular plane, or if we would tweak this or that, and so they could come back and give him information about how to improve the airplane design, basically. So I thought that was kind of an interesting way of how they kind of came about with funding that whole parapsychology thing.
Yeah, and it's so funny because none of the research that the Mac Lab was actually doing could ever come anywhere near no. answering that question, right?
No. No.
Can these guys bend spoons? What's that have to do
with apparently there was one fella who was there, I can't remember his name, Tom somebody, who was involved in the early part of that, who did seances and kinds of things and considered himself a psychic. Not a real one, I mean, but he was someone apparently who was a pseudo-psychic, but he was fooling them just as the other guys were. And he was doing rapping with his ankle, apparently, or something, you know. And they would answer questions because there was this rapping from beyond the dead or whatever. And that's sure. one of the things that Steve Shaw would do is whenever this guy would crack his knuckle or something, and, you know, Banachek would rap again, you know, to add another number to it or something to kind kind of screw up the guy. So he got kicked out early on of the whole project over there. Now, I assume, again, one of the reasons then, Tony, this is an ongoing project is that you're continuing to look for more subjects. Do you have a some sort of a quantity in mind that once you reach this critical mass, you will have an idea of, say, okay, we can now make a logical conclusion that this is what's happened?
Sort of, okay. Yeah. So in research, you can usually use prior research to inform how many participants you need to get at to really answer a question. But unfortunately, there's not really any prior research on any of the topics that I'm studying. Mm-hmm. So if I could get 20 expert magicians, I would be in good shape. And I am nowhere near that number.
Okay. Interesting.
But I should stress that this is also – this expertise thing is a very small part of what I'm doing in the laboratory. Most of the research that I do in the science of magic is using normal people who don't know anything about magic.
So you're training normal people, this coin trick basically, to come in, you mean? Or are they the people who are watching the magic?
So, for example, my work in how attention operates in time is inspired by magic but doesn't necessarily use magic in the laboratory. Okay, so here, for example, here's one of the hypotheses that I've been testing. Magicians frequently use rhythmic events to control when attention is deployed. My best example is David Williamson's Striking Vanish.
Okay, right? Good.
Where oftentimes you'll instantiate a rhythm with tapping this coin mm-hmm. before you make the coin visibly vanish.
All right.
And so what's happening when you create this rhythm? Well, something known as attentional entrainment is occurring, where patterns of neural activity in the brain actually align themselves in time with this rhythmic event to optimize perceptual processing at moments when you expect important things to be happening, and to sort of relax in between, because that's economical. But what that means is, when a person is locked into this rhythm, they can be blind to events that happen in between beats.
Okay.
And psychologists kind of know about this. They know about, they have the term intentional entrainment that they've applied to this, but they tend to only study it within one modality. So an auditory rhythm influencing auditory perception, or a visual rhythm influencing visual perception. But if magicians are doing this, they're frequently doing it across modalities. They're using music and speech to influence when you are attending visually. Mm-hmm. And that's really unknown to psychology. So, for example, one of the ways that I've translated this down into sort of simple laboratory research is to have participants looking at a screen of just colored noise, where every pixel is just a random color, and monitoring this for the onset of a really subtle dot, really hard to see. Well, while they're watching this screen, I have them listening to a set of tones that are rhythmic. They don't have to do anything with those tones. Those tones are just there, presented. Okay. And lo and behold, if that dot appears in between tones, people are slower and less accurate at detecting it than if that dot appears with the auditory rhythm, suggesting that people's visual attention can be influenced very easily mm-hmm. by the mere presence of an auditory rhythm. Exactly as many magicians would probably intuit through their use of rhythmic speech and music in their magic. So really, in a lot of ways, I'm trying to distill theory and ideas from magic down into their sort of purest components to study the reality of these things in the laboratory.
So not only music, but then their speech patterns could be almost hypnotic.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, some work that has been done has looked at how the brain responds to speech. And okay. It turns out that speech is a perfect device for entraining attention in this way. This is an aside, and this isn't conclusive, but it turns out that the duration of a syllable, the average syllable in speech, aligns perfectly with the natural rhythm that your brain falls into when it's processing information in the environment, that the time course of one of these neural oscillations aligns perfectly with the duration of a syllable in speech, suggesting that speech and language probably evolved to fit these constraints of the brain, these natural rhythms that the brain falls into automatically.
And so it can recognize that, and so it kind of goes along with it, because it's if something goes outside that range, then it's a surprise to them, basically.
Then it's harder to process.
Harder to process, gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the challenges of spoken language is figuring out like where one word ends and the next begins, because there are no auditory cues to that. We feel like speech has these discrete units, one word followed by another. But if you look at the auditory signal, it's continuous. It's just sound, 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 sound. There are no cues.
Mm-hmm.
And so these oscillatory mechanisms may help us break down where one word ends and the next begins by mapping perfectly onto syllable structure.
By carrying this on, I'm thinking to politicians that there are some speeches that are historic, Gettysburg Address or Kennedy's inaugural, a few things like this that are so well written. Do you think that has something to do with maybe the short sentences or the words, the syllables within there that has something to do with what exactly you're talking about?
I think so. I think you're absolutely right. I think both, I mean, a lot of them are poetic, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, sure.
And poetry tends to have a natural rhythm to
right.
it. But also the content matters.
Of course.
So there was an experiment that came out of Japan a few years back. And I will state right off the bat, I don't know that this has been replicated, so I don't know if this is real or not.
Mm-hmm.
But they had people watching someone giving a speech.
Mm-hmm.
And they could either, let me try and reconstruct how this worked. They either had full video and audio. They could watch the person speaking and hear the person speaking. In fact, I think it was a video from the West Wing, maybe, of the president and that giving a speech.
Mm-hmm.
Or they could only hear the audio and not have the video. Or they could only have the video and not be hearing the audio, which probably was no fun at all.
Mm-hmm.
And unbeknownst to these participants, they were measuring when their eyes blinked. And they found that when the person was watching the speech with full audio and full video, that the participants' blinks happened about 100 milliseconds after the person they were watching blinked. That their blinks entrained to the blinks of the speaker. If there was no video, this didn't happen because there was no evidence of blinks. And if there
sure.
was no no audio, it didn't really happen. So the narrative, the story being told, did matter. But if you had both of these, people seemed their behavior changed to sort of mirror the behavior of the speaker. And if this is a real effect, this is something that magicians might be harnessing without even knowing it, right? Like magicians use these elegant speech patterns. And if you can ensure that your audience is going to be blind by blinking 100 milliseconds after you blink, this could be something that we could potentially harness and use for evil. Right?
Yeah.
It's a way to almost guarantee that your audience is not going to be looking for a very brief window.
Yeah.
Or you can get away with a pass.
Right.
Or some subtle, quick piece of sleight of hand.
I was thinking that instead of it actually being a mirroring technique that they were doing, but it's just kind of like an acceptance. Okay, I understand that one. Let's move on to the next one. Okay, I understand that one whenever they blink and kind of move on. And that would be something that I would think as a magician that you could capitalize on, because mm-hmm. you're leading them down that road and you're saying, okay,
yeah.
they believe in premise A and B, and all of a sudden, boom, you know, that's just like,
sure.
I didn't see that coming, you know,
yeah.
kind of a thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's something that could be learned here for magicians. We just need to explore it a little
bit. Well, another thing is that I see a lot of magicians who will blink at the wrong time, and they signal whenever they're doing the move. It's if, in other words, I want them to be blinking, and if I'm closing my eyes and they can't see me, it's like my granddaughters are, you know, saying they're going to hide from me, and so they just close their eyes and put their hands over their eyes. It's like,
sure.
I'm invisible now. You know, it's like, well,
yeah.
you're still right there just because you can't see me. The same thing, I think, that sometimes magicians will be getting ready to do a pass, and as they do the move, that's whenever they blink or will
yeah.
clear their throat, or there'll be something that will tip the audience that's
sure.
Something's happened.
Well, Don't you think that probably comes from rehearsing in front of a mirror?
Well, you got that right.
It's an instance of self-deception, right?
That's a good point.
If you're watching yourself in the mirror and you blink when you're doing the secret move, you're fooling yourself into believing that you're far better at the secret move than you
may. That looked good. Yeah, I looked good there.
I didn't see a thing.
Exactly. Yeah, that was invisible over there then too. Well, it seems also, as far as trying, Tony, to get more people into the lab, have you thought about taking the lab to the people? In other words, of going to the magic conventions and saying, I'm going to have a room over here, and I'd like for you guys to sign up. I mean, it'd be a perfect place. You're going to be having the right people and a good group also who could be interested.
Yeah, and I've done a little bit of this with actually minimal success.
Really?
I think the magicians are just scared of putting themselves in this scenario, but I, again, need to stress that there's nothing
nefarious.
There's really no stress here.
Stress.
This is there's they don't have to live up to anything. They don't have to perform well. It doesn't really matter. And all of these things are confidential. Nobody's going to be seeing any of the data that I collect except for me and other researchers involved with the project. So there's nothing to be scared about. So now that I'm in Kenosha, Wisconsin, I'm about an hour north of Chicago. So I'm really hoping that I can persuade some Chicago magicians to take part in this, because I know that's it's a rich, large community. And I'm about a half an hour from Milwaukee, and there's a pretty active set of magicians up there too. So I'm hoping that being in this more bustling urban area, I'll be able to beef up my research participants.
Right. I know the Big Guys is a place there in Pewaukee that you can go to, and they host lectures and they have magicians coming in.
Haven't gotten there yet. Only been here a month.
Okay. Well, I would think that by joining some of the clubs and going in and telling them in advance, they send out emails and saying, hey, look, we're going to be having this gentleman who's going to be coming, and here's what we'd like to do. If anyone would like to participate, be available, and we'll take you over in the room or whatever else, and it's all confidential or whatever. So I would think a little at a time, certainly, that you could do that. I know they have several theaters. John Sterk has put together this thing on Thursday nights that they have with Magic Chicago, and there are some other kinds of things in which they have some magicians, certainly, who are busy. I mean, you're in a very good place where I think you have a good group to call on. My issue, or my question also has to do with the right now with the coin moves. You're saying, okay, well, I'm going to teach somebody this coin move. They may or may not necessarily know this routine. That's immaterial, but this is what they're going to perform then. And so you had said earlier, and rightly so, that there are so many different rooms, I guess, in this house, of course, whether it's going to be children's magic or mentalism or balloon twister or whatever, that try and teach a stage guy to do a coin trick might be a little bit different. And so I guess, are you wanting to test all magicians and kind of force them into this funnel, as opposed to say, okay, you're going to learn this stage illusion because you're an illusionist, and you're going to learn this mentalist effect because you're a mentalist, and you're going to learn a card trick because you're a card guy?
We picked a coin routine because of some of the variables that we're exploring.
Okay. Without going into too much detail, I understand.
But it's not about being good at the coin routine. It's about just giving it a good college try. And they don't even have to get through the whole thing. Just do the best they can. I even had a balloon twister participate, and he gave it a good college try on the coin routine, and I appreciated it. And he came away happy. For all those who may be scared of this, he left the lab happy.
Good. And you were satisfied, too, because you had a participant, I guess. You had a subject.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I think to distill another one of the concerns that I think magicians may have, I think because of some of the things that people like Ricky Jay have been saying about the scientific study of magic, there's a fear that I'm in the exposure business. Mm-hmm. And this is not at all about exposure. I'm not exposing secrets to anyone and have no intention of doing so. In many ways, I'm just trying to get at the techniques, the psychological techniques that magicians use to deceive, and use those as a way to advance our understanding of the mind. Mm-hmm. This is because magicians have all of this knowledge, it's an untapped resource for psychologists. It's a way to speed up the rate of discovery in the psychological sciences. So it's, there are no nefarious goals here. I'm not in the exposure business. And by participating in this experiment, you will not be exposing anything to anyone. I should just say that right off the bat.
Okay. And obviously their names are not going to, because of the confidentiality, their names won't be used in any of the results or whatever like that.
It's confidential.
Well. Sure.
Yep.
Just trying to get some sort of a critical mass that you can then.
Yep.
Are you working on a paper that you're going to be publishing at some point, I assume, as part of this?
That's the hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I can get enough participants and have enough data to actually analyze, there will be papers that would come out of this. And I should also note that similar projects are happening over in Europe.
Oh.
Gustav Kuhn, friend and collaborator, has been working with the Magic Circle, giving a series of lectures to magicians there on the psychological study of magic. And he's also recruiting for participants for a similar set of studies that he's doing. So those magicians in the UK should be open to this too, I hope. And it sounds like they have been. He's had great luck with the Magic Circle.
And is his project kind of running hand in glove with yours, such that, in other words, are you racing to see who's going to publish the paper first?
Oh, we're testing different hypotheses. We've conversed about this. We're not competitive.
Okay.
We're sort of working together.
gotcha.
Yeah, okay. we're not fighting each other on this.
Okay.
there's a lot of meat on the magical bone here,
so to speak.
We can each study our own things and not step on each other's feet.
Right. And so you first started this at least, what, 3 years ago?
Well, I guess my first publication on the science of magic was in 2010, not long after the Sleights of Mind book came out. Mm-hmm. And it was around that time that I started doing laboratory research on this stuff. Recently, there was a special issue of a journal called Frontiers in Psychology, which is an online journal that anybody can access. An entire special issue on the science of magic.
Hmm.
I'd be happy to give you a link to that, but I published a piece in there studying attentional, not attention in time, but spatial attention in the context of a magic trick.
Okay.
Using eye tracking technology and an effect that I adapted from a David Riegel effect. And I will say no more so as not to spoil it if people decide to go look at the paper.
Yeah, say no more, hush, hush, wink, wink. Okay. And so the results of the tests and the paper, once it gets out, will it be something you think that will benefit, I understand, the public in general having a better understanding about what we're doing, but have applications that magicians can see that and say, oh, I think I can apply this?
Absolutely. Especially for this set of experiments, I think the outcomes could help us learn how to rehearse better.
Okay.
And how to optimize the way that we practice magic to aid in later deception.
Mm-hmm. Because there's a right and wrong way of practicing, and rehearsal and practice are two separate things, of course.
Exactly. Too, but, I think there are certain traps that magicians can fall into in their rehearsal procedures that could actually harm later deception.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we're trying to get at with this set of experiments.
Just as we were talking about where you were going to be blinking or something, that you think, okay, that's looks good, and so you actually go out and do it that way, and then the more you do it, you are in that habit, and you really don't change unless someone tells you. You're not going to, it's always going to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
So if you practice bad habits, you're going to develop those.
Absolutely. I think we all have our bad performance habits.
Well, sure.
And I'm becoming attuned to... So I hate it when people have these sort of... I just did it. These verbal patterns that they fall into again and again. And my wife has just informed me that I say sort of all the time. And so and those are other performance habits that people could fall into. And I'm trying to fight my urge to say sort of.
Oh, absolutely. I understand that. I took a Toastmasters class to try to get rid of some of those ums and ahs or to find out what is it that I'm saying in between. You know, it could be that you're one thing magicians will say, and for my next trick. or let me show you this. Or I tell you, well, one thing that I do that I'm trying to avoid, but I hear other magicians are saying, what I want you to do is this.
Mm-hmm. Just or do me a favor.
Or yeah, do me
a favor. Blank.
Yeah, exactly. just say hold this deck of cards. You know,
sure.
Or in just a minute, I'm going to have you take out the card from that deck. Okay, now go ahead and take a card out of the deck.
That's right.
So just tell them what to do and not explain. It seems like that. You know, you're not sure where you're going with that. It's poor scripting or no scripting, in which I think that you could develop again there that bad habit. And that's what I'm saying. The advantage of Toastmasters is that you start to get rid of some of those things because people will be pointing out to you and ringing the bell and everything. So I highly recommend for those who haven't taken Toastmasters, they do. I still have a lot of uhs and ahs and things, as people who have listened to my podcast on a regular basis can recognize that I still do, but I'm trying to avoid those.
Well, and I think tying it back to attention, these sorts of tics could easily kick people out of rhythmic entrainment, especially if they begin capturing attention independently of the meaning that you're actually trying to communicate.
Hmm.
Right?
Hmm.
So we've all been there. We've been in a show and we've identified one of these verbal tics that a performer has. And what happens? Every time that tic comes up, it captures our attention. And we're thereby disengaged from the narrative and less likely to have our attention being choreographed by the magician.
There are a lot of comedians who will have that, and they use that to their advantage, and that's their thing, if you will. You know, that they have that little tic or nuance or something, how they'll shrug their shoulder or kind of look away or have an aside comment that they'll make or whatever, and that's their thing, you know, they get to be known for. And I think that some magicians who differentiate themselves from others will have this kind of, Jeff Hobson comes to mind, who would have some sort of a flamboyant type of a thing and gestures with his hands, and he goes over and beyond the norm, it seems like, in order to try to gesture and whatever.
But his magic is incredibly powerful, so I'm imagining that he actually choreographs those quirks so that they complement rather than distracting from the effects that he's performing.
And Matt King also taking advantage of kind of that country bumpkin type of character whenever that he's putting his hands to his side and something's happening under his jacket or his coat or whatever, or in his pant pocket, that people think that it's just part of your normal fumbling about or whatever, but actually you're doing something, you know, or the goofiness of David Williamson that you mentioned earlier, the strike vanish, where he's, you know, doing things and moving kids around or trying to adjust or whatever, that actually there's a lot of brilliant thinking that's going on before that show, so he knows why he's doing each of those things.
Absolutely. And I should say, just to give a shout out, Mack King has been a great friend to the scientific study of magic. He's been a great supporter, and he was actually an author on one of the papers with Steve Macnick and Susanna Martinez-Conde recently. And he's been very supportive of the classes that I've taught using on the psychology of magic. In fact, in my last semester teaching the class at Northern Arizona University, we did a trip. We drove to Vegas. The whole class went to the Mack King show, and he was kind enough to give us a little chat afterwards and a peek into some of the techniques that he was using and the thought that motivated some of his decisions. And it was really illuminating for my students who'd been thinking about a lot of these things in the abstract throughout the semester. And then to see a master magician implement these, I don't claim to be a master magician, to see him put these things into practice in such an entertaining and successful way was really illuminating for them.
So it is. And
I love Mack.
Oh, boy, do I also. And I recommend his show to any and everybody who goes to Vegas. If people or friends are saying to go, you know, what should we see or do? And I say, I don't care about what the evening shows or whatever, or Cirque du Soleil, go see Mack King for sure. But one thing, talking about the psychology, about how much he thinks, and this may be one of the things he had shared with you, is that whenever that he has a lady sign a card, and that more times than not she signs the back of the card, and he makes some comment about saying, well, you know, it's going to be easier to find now, you know, because you signed that. that. So he's got an extra joke that he has in there. And I was asking him about how can he assure that he gets people to sign that. And he will actually point to the back of the card with the pen. And
a simple gesture.
Simple gesture. And then they think that's where they're supposed to write. And then he'll turn away from them with the pen as he's talking to the audience. And then when he turns her back around, they've written on the back of the card. You know, 90% of the time that they have done exactly where they've shown him, he's shown them to write. Is that one of the things he had mentioned to you also?
Absolutely. The illusion of spontaneity is such a big part of Mac's show. And when he let my students in on a couple of those bits, their heads exploded. They couldn't believe that night after night, the lady would sign the card on the wrong side. Or night after night, she would put the cards in her bra rather than putting them in a pocket or something like that.
Right.
That was one of the things that I think really stuck with them, how subtle suggestions can completely change behavior.
Certainly so. And if you get a chance to take your students to go see The Supernaturalist that is touring then right now with Chris Angel's Supernaturalist, and of course Banachek is one of the featured performers of that, to get him aside a little bit to talk about that. Of course, the book series of Psychological Subtleties is something that his whole being, his performance, his persona is based upon those little subtleties. It's not the revelation, that, you know, the word you're thinking of is whatever, but it's the way that a person is thinking of that that word or whatever. And for an example, that's in talking about psychological little suggestions, where that he would say, I want you to think of two geometric shapes, one inside the other. And so as he's explaining that, then he is showing you in space with his finger and making a circle with a triangle. So that he is implanting those psychological kinds of suggestions that you can't avoid.
Yeah, absolutely. And Darren Brown with his Three of Diamonds, his psychological Three of Diamonds force is an exercise in psychology. It's beautiful. It's the problem is that we have this whole structure that people refer to as NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, which is really kind of a red herring, and it's one of the things that I try to fight in some of my classes. There are much simpler explanations for how these things are accomplished that are a little more supported by science. The Three of Diamonds force and the thing that you were talking about Banachek doing. The mechanism that is likely to underlie this is something, a simple mechanism known as priming, where we are constantly trying to predict events that are going to happen in the world around us. And we're using prior experience to shape that. Mm-hmm. And so any little environmental cue that can activate concepts that will help us predict what's about to happen, we'll take advantage of unconsciously. And so drawing these things in the air can bias us in certain directions by virtue of our constant use of subtle environmental cues to shape our behavior optimally. I should warn magicians that, and most, I think a lot of magicians know this now, NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, has some little kernels of truth in it, but by and large, it's a pseudoscience. It was developed by a couple of guys who kind of just made it up and admitted that it wasn't based on any kind of research. Yet it's been adopted like gangbusters in the magic community in a way that scares me a little bit. And it's even kind of a failure as therapeutic techniques go. Because it doesn't have a basis in real science. And anytime little kernels of it are actually put to the test, they fail. People like Richard Weissman have done some experiments to test things like visual accessing cues. The idea that if you're pulling up an auditory memory, your eyes will look in one direction while you're doing it. And these things just don't hold up to empirical scrutiny. And so we should avoid them, and by invoking NLP in our explanations of our magic tricks, we're actually helping this ascientific practice continue. So I think we should jump ship on the NLP bandwagon and try and use more coherent explanations for the things that we do that are actually supported by science.
That's a different perspective, certainly. I don't buy into NLP personally, but I would use that as an explanation to the audience to say, this is how you are being influenced. And they can say, oh, that makes sense. Yeah, I guess I was believing that. But from what you're saying is we shouldn't be telling our audiences that because, again, that's continuing to...
Yeah, I think it's dangerous because it gives... Even if you're using it as a talking point, as a fictional narrative structure for your effect, people may not realize that it's a fiction. And if they then visit a therapist who claims to be using NLP procedures, they're going to give those procedures extra weight that they don't deserve.
Mm-hmm.
So just as there are arguments about whether mentalists should give disclaimers about whether they're actually psychics or not, I think it's probably healthier and better for society if we abandon NLP as a talking point and our effects.
Well, what about that? I was leading right into that, my next question about disclaimers, of whether that you think, in, for mentalists in particular, whether that they should be giving a disclaimer or not, and how, if so, how should it be formed?
Man, it's a hard one. I don't have a great answer for it, and I'm not a mentalist. I've never called myself one. I tend to think that we do need to help the audience appreciate that this is a theatrical endeavor, that this is a performance, and that this isn't some sort of mirror on reality. I think that there is danger in facilitating the propagation of some of these pseudoscientific beliefs.
I believe that our art is different from that of any other craft. That is, whether it's going to be a movie, a play, or music. When somebody, again, is coming out in the theater and say, well, tonight I'm going to be playing the part of Macbeth, but I'm really not Macbeth. You know, I mean, that's obviously they're not going to be saying that. Or in the movie, you know, these were CGI effects. Whereas that without the disclaimer, people have a certain preconception, or I should say belief system, that they bring to the party. And so they are either dispelled and they're now skeptics, or that they are now believers after they leave your show if you are not saying, hey, I'm just here to entertain you tonight.
Yeah. I mean, I think the major distinction here is that mentalism and magic are self-aware in a way that theater isn't. Right, we make it our business to break the fourth wall.
Correct.
It's not a one directional performance. It's
Correct.
An interactive thing, and that's kind of rare, I think, in most theater. Right,
Correct.
Macbeth maintains that fourth wall most of the mm-hmm. time, and so I think that's where the difference lies, that necessitates some sort of a disclaimer or some sort of an acknowledgement that this is a theatrical endeavor, and not like a formal lecture,
I see what you're getting at, and that seems to make sense, as opposed to an illusionist or a magician who's doing cards and coin tricks. They know, people recognize that this is sleight of hand. This is something that's just fun, and I don't understand. This person has developed this skill. However, that when someone is doing mentalism, people don't understand about the psychology and what the mind can do. And again, people have different belief systems in the beyond or seances or one thing or another, and how that perhaps people can be made to believe something. Maybe that a disclaimer would be more appropriate, certainly in a mentalist show as opposed to a magician's or a magic show, because magic, they go, yeah, that's fun. That's just in the box. I don't know. It's a puzzle box. I don't understand it, but they know that it's a trick. But mentalism, it's like, it's not a trick. That is a real deal, you know?
Yeah, feels different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Well, that's been fascinating, and I've certainly learned a lot here. And if people want to contact you, let's say who live in the Chicago up in that area and want to come into the lab or whatever, how would they get in touch with you?
I've got a website. I have not yet changed it from my affiliation with Northern Arizona University to Carthage College, but it's still up there, and it will continue to be up there at anthonybarnhart.com. I'm on Twitter at Magic Tony, and you can find me if you do a Google search for Anthony Barnhart or even Tony Barnhart, I'll be among the top hits, although there is that sports commentator who is Tony Barnhart.
There's another guy there, too. What about on Facebook? You on Facebook then as well?
I'm on the Facebook machine, sure. Yeah.
Okay. As Anthony Barnhart or as Tony Barnhart?
Anthony Barnhart, yeah. But, okay. But that itself is deceptive. I use... if someone calls me Anthony, I know that it means they don't know me very well. So call me Tony.
Yeah. Okay. And let me just kind of conclude, because the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, to ask you what your word is. That is, what is your phrase or what is your philosophy of life? It doesn't have to be a word. It could be a sentence. Or what's important to you?
Well, I think curiosity would be great. A magic word. I mean, I'm in the business of... producing thinkers and producing citizens of the world at the collegiate level. Mm-hmm. And the hallmark of a successful student and a person who's going to succeed in life is curiosity. And I think that's something that has led most people to magic as well, right? Like, that's how you get into magic. You experience this weird thing that piques your curiosity to learn. And I think that is an important thing for us to maintain throughout our lives.
Sure.
Constant curiosity for mysterious things.
Yeah, from cradle to grave. That's important to continue to ask questions and to learn from those. Excellent. Well, Tony, thank you very much. You've been a wonderful guest, and I appreciate you sharing some of your ideas and everything, and I hope that all the experiments all turn out, I was going to say, the way you want them to, but you don't have a preconceived way of how
they
want
them to. Hope they turn out some way.
Hopefully sooner than later, so you can get the paper published
right.
And move on to something else then as well. So it's been great. Thank you very much. And for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Tony Barnhart, and this is Scotty out.
We're about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker 5.
Well, this podcast was a little bit different from the stories that are usually shared on this podcast when we talk about other magicians, but this was a little bit more esoteric and theoretical, and I hope that you enjoyed it. And if you have an opportunity to help him out on this study and live anywhere near the Kenosha, Wisconsin area or in Chicago area, that you will reach out and try to talk with Tony and see about how you can help him with this project. I think it sounds like a wonderful endeavor and ultimately will help us all. So, let me again say thank you, Tony, for being on this week's podcast, and also I want to thank you, the listener, for tuning in to The Magic Word and listening each week to these podcasts. If you have an opportunity and you haven't yet liked our Facebook page, please go over to Facebook.com and just look for or do a search for The Magic Word Podcast. Hit that and then like our page. That way that you can kind of keep up to date with all the information that is being shared there and all the new podcasts as they are being released, and also gives you some information on some of the things that are coming up as well. And you can also keep up with us on Twitter by following us at Magic Word Pod. So, until next time, stay well, get booked, and read a book on psychology. This is Scotty out.